My thanks to Lee Spiegel, our first hour guest. We have contact information, a link to Lee, where you can send him comments or story ideas on our Coast to Coast website. And I think he likes to get input from the public and will likely respond to any email you send to him. I know that I spent some time today, as I do almost every day, trying to respond to emails from Coast listeners. And I don't know what the technical problem is, but on good days, about half of the emails that I send out get through. On bad days, almost none of them get through. I do try to respond to all the emails that you send in, but the responses just haven't been getting through, and no one can quite figure out what it is. But I hope it's a problem we're going to get fixed, and I think it is something that befuddles all of us here on Coast to Coast AM, but we do welcome your input, and we do try to respond to your inquiries and comments. My next guest is Nick Redfern, whose new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, is disturbing stuff. In the introduction, Nick writes that rather this is a study of the many and varied people who have immersed themselves in this cosmic mystery only to turn up stone cold dead and under deeply suspicious circumstances. And believe me, this material in the book is deeply disturbing. We're going to jump right into it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Nick Redfern is a ufologist and cryptozoologist, author of many books on UFOs, cryptozoology, the paranormal, and conspiracy theories. I think I read somewhere he's written 20 books. He writes regularly for UFO Magazine, Fate Magazine, and others, and has helped to uncover thousands of pages of previously classified documents from the Royal Air Force, the Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense, files on UFOs and other topics. And it's always good to have him on the program. Nick, good to have you back.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on again.
Great book. I've very much enjoyed it in a spooky, scary kind of a way. I want to start this way. I shared with you some emails of your fellow ufologists who said, oh, gosh, here comes Nick with a scary story, and he's doing nobody any good by making us think that aliens are evil or the government is evil. Let's just get that out of the way. What do you say to those guys?
Well, you know, I mean, when it comes to the whole issue of ufology, the fact is that there have been some unusual deaths in the subject, and there's no point, as I see it, in trying to, you know, deny those cases exist or that the deaths didn't occur. They clearly did, and for that reason, they need addressing. I think that if people just want to see the positive side of the phenomenon, well, they're just, you know, they're sort of looking at it from one perspective, instead of looking at it from every perspective. And I don't believe in ignoring data because it's unsettling or it doesn't fit into one particular belief system. And the, you know, when you look into this angle of unusual deaths in relation to the UFO field, it's a real phenomenon. And I just don't understand the concept of ignoring that.
I'm with you on that. You know, I mentioned in the beginning of the program, I don't think you were able to hear it, but in the beginning of the program, I said, you know, we've been having these alien editorials for 50 years, the first contactees who were told, hey, you humans need to take care of your planet, stop blowing up nuclear weapons, control pollution, or else something bad's going to happen, as if they really care about us. I think the most you could say about these visitors or others or whatever they are is that they would be agnostic about humans, that I guess they have the technology to blow us all up or wipe us off the face of the earth if they wanted to. But you look at the overall consequences, they haven't destroyed us, but they haven't done us any favors either.
No, you're right. And I think the phenomenon is often viewed by people as from a very simplistic perspective. You know, the aliens are good. They come here to help us. Well, you know, the human race isn't necessarily good or bad. You know, we all have the capability to be good and to be bad. You know, most people use common sense and realize where the line should not be crossed, you know. And if there are intelligent entities out there, then I don't see why they should be any different. And I think it's a little bit naive to take a stance that everything is just all love and light and, you know, positive. It clearly isn't. And, you know, I have a problem when people deny the darker side of the subject because it does exist. You know, it's a shame that it does. It'd be better if it didn't, but it does. So.
I guess if you buy the idea, and some people don't, if you buy the idea that there is some sort of visitation or at least interaction with some other kind of intelligence, that it may be multiple intelligences, and therefore it could be multiple agendas. It's not just one agenda, it could be several.
Yeah, and I think this sort of demonstrates how little we really know about the intelligences behind the phenomenon. Clearly, there's a genuine UFO phenomenon. Clearly, people see UFOs and have had interaction with the entities behind them. But we have to ask the question, when these events occur, abductions and things like this, and we're told it's for our own good and it's going to help the future, you know, my view has always been, why do so many people take those stories at face value? Why should it be the case that we're being told the truth? Maybe there is an even deeper, darker side that we don't know about, and we're being deceived, you know, just totally across the board. But again, people don't want to hear that, unfortunately.
I'm with you. I view it as sort of alien advertising. It's like a pitch man saying, you know, buy these tires. They'll save your life someday. Not necessarily the best tires for you to buy, or not necessarily good tires at all.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell me this. How did you get the idea for this, this book? I mean, you cast a wide net and include a lot of stories, some stories that I heard before, some that I have never heard even an inkling about. I mean, did you watch the movie E.T. Once too often and figure you needed to balance things out?
actually, that's a good point, but no. I guess there's sort of two things, really. One is, whenever I'm writing a new book, and, you know, if people are going to buy it, you want to be able to give them something new. So I always look for a new angle to write about. And over the years, I think most people have heard about the occasional unusual death within the UFO field. But I realized that nobody had ever sort of tackled the subject from the 40s to the present day in the form of a full-length book specifically on that topic. So I spent about 18 months digging into some of the well-known cases, but as you point out as well, a lot of cases that people just simply would not have been aware of, and then, you know, looked at them all chronologically, saw where the evidence lay and the theories and so on, and then decided, yeah, this would be a good book for people who are interested in not just so much the darker side of ufology, but how and why and the many and varied reasons as to why people have met mysterious ends in the UFO field. And I would hope, you know, people sort of perceive it as a valuable contribution to this aspect of the phenomenon.
Oh, I'd say it definitely is that and more. You jump right into the deep end of the pool right at the beginning of this book. There's a part of the chapter is dubbed The Melting Man. And you tell this story about something that happened in 1946 in a Brazilian village. You know, you must get this question a lot. I get the question a lot as well in association with cattle mutilations. Animals are carved up. Some people think it's aliens that are doing it, or humans and aliens. And have there ever been any kind of cases where humans get carved up or slashed up or burned? And you start right off the bat with a pretty dramatic case. Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, sure. This one actually dates 1 year before the modern era of ufology began in 47. This was March 1946 and involved a Brazilian farmer named Prestes Filho, who lived in a little village in one particular part of Brazil, and walking home late one night to the little village, and everything seemed normal at first. And he had this sort of sense of that we all get from now and again of being watched. You know, that sort of sense that somebody's sort of looking over your shoulder, and suddenly you turn around and sure enough, they are. He had that kind of feeling, couldn't shake it off. Well, he finally got back home. It was late at night. He'd been out fishing all day. Went to his home, still had this strange feeling, and felt compelled to look outside the window of his home. As he did so, he was suddenly bathed in a bright light, which emanated from some sort of bright object that was stationary in the sky. And he suddenly felt very, very hot, almost as if he was starting to cook. And according to the story, that's exactly what happened, that it wasn't as if he'd just been sort of affected by, you know, a sunburn or something like that. He got hotter and hotter and fell sick. And eventually, friends in the village came around quickly raced over to see him to hear what all the screaming was about, and said that his skin was literally starting to peel off his body. Now, it didn't stop there. It was almost as if, with hindsight, he'd been affected by something like a microwave. You know, if you cook food in a microwave, the reason why they tell you to let it stand afterwards is because the food is actually still cooking. The microwaves are still cooking. And that seems to be a similar analogy to what happened to Philho, is that his body continued to cook and literally melt. And there was what was essentially like a race to the local hospital to try and save him. And by the time they got him to the hospital, his skin was literally falling off in chunks, and he supposedly melted right before the eyes of the doctors. Now, it sounds a controversial story, except for the fact that a number of the people who were involved are still alive today and have gone on record as talking about this case and their recollections of seeing him and the man's body just unfortunately melting away. Now, of course, that doesn't happen under any normal circumstances, and it's significant that it was tied in with the sighting of this strange light in the sky that specifically and directly beamed this light down at Philho. So the only way I can kind of rationalize this is that it was an outright hostile act. There doesn't seem to be any other reason for it.
Nick, I've seen some photos over the years of what purports to be, I don't know if it's the same case, I think it is from Brazil, of a guy who was really burned, severely burned, and cut up or carved up. Do you know what photos I'm talking about, and is that the same thing? Have you seen photos associated with this case?
I haven't seen photos associated with this one, but there are a few different pictures from various parts of South America. South America actually has a lot of very violent UFO reports over the years. Jacques Vallée collected a lot of reports from Brazil, and many of those have a hostile aspect to them. But I have an entire chapter in the book on human mutilations that kind of parallel the cattle mutilation phenomenon. And thankfully, at least the number of reports that we know of aren't that many. But even, you know, one, you could argue, is one too many. And I think when you talk about human mutilations, then you're really getting into, you know, the very dark side of the phenomenon.
Well, we are going to talk about it a little bit later. Before we leave this case, we should point out, I mean, this was 1946 in the middle of the jungle out in Brazil. And it's not like the U.S. had planes or helicopters flying around armed with microwave weapons at that time.
No, that's right. I mean, there's several important factors about this. One, the object was hovering, and yes, there were helicopters at the time, but you know they weren't anywhere near as widespread as today. On top of that, it was just a little remote village. Third thing, the object, whatever it was totally silent. And then, of course, there was this sort of powerful beam weapon, or however you want to describe it. And clearly, you know, nobody from here, at least, was flying something that possessed that technology, you know, almost 70 years ago. So I think we can sort of state with a fair degree of, you know, accuracy that this was a genuine UFO incident.
The other case you jump into in this early in the book is Maury Island. And I'll tell you, this is, it's something that I've just sort of glossed over the years. I know it's important, but it's so hard to follow these characters. It's confusing, but you do a really good job of sort of boiling it down to its essence. And it's important because it's right there at the birth of the modern UFO era. Tell us about that story.
Well, this actually occurred just a couple of days before Kenneth Arnold's famous encounter on June 24, 1947, at a place called Maury Island, which is in Tacoma in Washington State. And the story involved a man named Harold Dahl, who worked the local harbor, sort of picking up wreckage and bits of, you know, debris, etc., so that, you know, it wouldn't interfere with the passage of the boats that traveled the area. And he and his crew were out on their boat in the harbor one particular day when they saw what essentially you could describe as like a squadron of flying saucers. They were kind of donut-shaped with hollowed-out centers. One of these objects seemed to be malfunctioning in the sense it was wobbling in the sky and then reportedly exploded, showering down this strange wreckage into the harbour, which was essentially two different types of wreckage. One was like a very light foil, and the other was more like a slag-type material. And Harold Dahl and his crew looked on in amazement as this occurred. The other object shot away at high speed. And they returned to the shore, by which time some of this wreckage was starting to wash up on the shore. So they collected it all up, and Dahl handed some of it over to his superior within the shipwork, a man named Fred Chrisman, who, interestingly enough, turned up in the Kennedy assassination years later. Well, Chrisman contacted local media, and it wasn't long before the military got hold of the story as well, which, not surprising, because they were talking, the press were talking about strange wreckage from a UFO. And what happened was that two military officers from Army Intelligence, a First Lieutenant Frank Mercer Brown and a Captain William Lee Davidson of Army Intelligence, they flew out to Maury Island. The intention was they would pick some of this wreckage up and take it to what at the time was called Wright Field, today called Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, which has a long history of involvement in the UFO subject. Well, what happened was that Mercer Brown and Davidson took to the skies from Maury Island with this wreckage. Actually didn't get far at all, unfortunately, because their aircraft, a Boeing B-29, actually burst into flames not long after takeoff, crashed to the ground, and both men were killed. Now, interestingly and suspiciously, the wreckage that they returned with was never found. Whether or not somebody else got to the crash site first, we don't know. But that was only the beginning of the deaths. Two of the local media guys who also reported on the incident, they died under unusual circumstances, and to the point where the people doing the autopsy couldn't really figure out what it was that had killed them. And even Kenneth Arnold, responsible for essentially kicking the UFO subject off in the summer of 47, was actually hired by Ray Palmer, the editor of Amazing Stories magazine, to go out to Maury Island to investigate the case, which he did. And when Arnold had completed his investigation and was returning home, he took to the skies in his aircraft and almost was killed himself. He was only through his skill as a pilot that Arnold managed to land his plane. And it turned out that whoever had refueled the plane prior to Arnold's takeoff had failed to shut the fuel valve. And so what happened was that when the aircraft took to the skies, the fuel actually froze in the tank, and Arnold was very lucky not to be killed. So we had four deaths in one case, two military people, two media people, almost the death of the man who single-handedly ushered in the modern era of ufology, and all revolving around this strange wreckage found in Maury Island.
I was thinking to myself, I had never read the part about Kenneth Arnold almost dying, and I guess it's just his sheer skill as a pilot that kept him alive. But the idea that whoever refueled the aircraft left the fuel valve open, yeah, that could happen. But when you have it on back-to-back-to-back-to-back deaths, it seems less like a coincidence.
Yeah, if it was just Arnold's plane, you could say it was just some terrible accident. You know, somebody just made a major mistake. But when we've got, all within a matter of days, you know, Mercer Brown and Davidson from Army Intelligence dead, you know, the wreckage gone, the two guys from the media, one of them a man named Ted Morello, who actually warned Arnold that he to get out of town because there were strange things going down. So, you know, very, very weird situation, that's just a massive catalogue of deaths, if you like.
We're talking with Nick Redfern about close encounters of the fatal kind. When we come back, Roswell, the granddaddy of UFO stories, had some deaths and some death threats, and we're going to get into that in a moment. We're talking with Nick Redfern about his new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. You might think you've heard it all about the Roswell case. I mean, so much has been written and said about that case, but you haven't heard this. Coming up, some information about a possible alien virus on the ground and the terrible effects it had back there in the late 1940s. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. 25 years ago this summer, I made my first visit to Roswell, New Mexico, following in the paths of a lot of researchers who had been down there checking stuff out about the Roswell mystery. And one of the guys I interviewed had never done a TV interview before. His name is Glenn Dennis, and he was the mortician in Roswell in 1947 during the time when the craft, whatever it was, crashed. And he told me a really interesting story about confirming a sort of a rumor that had been around about the Army requesting these tiny little caskets, child-sized caskets. Well, it turns out that that story is, of course, Glenn Dennis is now well-known in the Roswell field, and his story has made the rounds. But there's some angles to it that Nick Redfern explores in his new book that I had not heard before. Nick, tell us about, recap for us the story about Glenn Dennis and how that leads into the story you tell about this nurse, the mystery nurse.
Yeah, sure. Well, Glenn Dennis, as you point out, surfaced with his story in the late 1980s, how when he was a mortician in Roswell in 1947, that he was contacted by the military, who wanted to know if he had any small caskets, and asked sort of all sorts of questions about the preservation of bodies and so forth. And it was clear to Dennis that something strange was going on out at the base. And so he traveled out there, puzzled by, you know, the questions and so forth, and met with someone who initially he described as a nurse friend at the base, who was in a state of essentially like a combination of shock and fear. And she said that these strange little bodies had been brought in, and she'd seen them, and, you know, they were sort of terrible and creepy to see. And I say she was almost in like a state of shock. And Dennis actually didn't talk about this publicly until sort of 1989, 1990, when his story first really began to come out. Now, by Dennis's own admission, he never revealed the real name of the nurse. And so this made it problematic for people to try and find her. And various people have been put forward over the years, but as I point out in the book, the most likely candidate was a woman named Miriam Bush. She actually wasn't a nurse at the base, but she was an executive secretary who worked under the chief medical officer at the base, a man named Lieutenant Colonel Harold Warne. Now, Miriam Bush, why her story is so significant is that her family has gone on record as stating that she told her family of the events at Roswell back in 1947. In other words, she didn't wait, like Glenn Dennis, 30, 40, 50 years. She actually told her family at the time, and it became like one of these sort of classic dark family secrets that nobody wants to talk about. But when the story surfaced and Roswell became sort of, you know, known across pretty much the entire world, then her family decided to go public and said, yes, you know, the family was told about this by Miriam years ago. Now, what's particularly disturbing is that, as you rightly point out, in 1989, Dennis began to tell his story. Well, it was actually later in 1989 that Miriam Bush, who by that time was living essentially in fear, paranoia, and descended into complete alcoholism. She was found dead in a hotel room. Now, what was very weird is that, number one, she'd actually signed into the hotel room using her sister's name and address. And although it was said to have been suicide, when she was found, she actually had like a polythene plastic bag over her head, over her head, and bruises on her arms. Now, you can look at it from the angle that, yes, she just committed suicide. Certainly her family said she was frightened and she was worried that she was being watched and followed. And the big question, of course, is, well, why should that have been the case? And if we look at the time frame, this was actually just months after Glenn Dennis told his story.
Actually, it might be closer than that, Nick, because we interviewed him in July. He told me it was his first interview ever, but we didn't air it until November, the first week in November.
Well, that's interesting, because it was right at the end of 1989 that Miriam Bush was found dead. Now, when we sort of address this particular issue, I think what's important is that Miriam Bush in 1989 could well have been one of the very few last surviving people who actually saw the bodies and could talk about them from seeing them up close and personal, so to speak, and could have really added to the story, and who had a highly credible background. You know, most of the people who who were at Roswell either died earlier or told family members, or they were responsible picking up pieces of wreckage. But Miriam Bush was someone who was really in the thick of things. So, you know, it's kind of highly disturbing that just after Glenn Dennis went public, that she became very fearful she was being watched and then suddenly turned up dead. It sounds like something straight out of the X-Files until we realise that, you know, it's all too true. Miriam Bush really did end her days dead in a hotel room with a plastic bag over her head.
And only a few weeks after Glenn Dennis revealed to the public, or his story was made public, that such a nurse existed. That's spooky stuff. Almost as spooky as the other stuff you have about Roswell, and this really is right out of the X-Files. You talk about the spread of these strange viruses in that area at the same time, and you would think, well, that sounds like something somebody would make up, some UFO researcher's fantasy. Except that you came up with some documents from the FBI that discuss this, that coincide, and it raises the hair on your arms.
Yeah, well this relates to a controversial story that first surfaced in the mid-1990s from a California researcher named Timothy Cooper, who's now out of the UFO subject. But Cooper claimed to have various old-timer contacts in the military who'd shared information and data with him, some of which related to an alleged outbreak of a very strange virus, excuse me, at the crash site of the Roswell event and possibly other crashed UFO events in New Mexico in the same time frame. And according to the information given to Cooper, a number of the technicians and retrieval people involved in the event suddenly felt very quickly sick, fell ill, began bleeding from the mouth and the nose, and fell victim to some sort of virus that affected them, not unlike something like Ebola, just took them very, very quickly, and essentially, as I said, they were just sort of bleeding from every orifice, so to speak. And the story, of course, as I said, was one told to Cooper essentially off the record by a number of these retired elderly people he'd been speaking to. Now, that story had always fascinated me. And so I began looking into it, really to see what else was going on in Lincoln County, New Mexico, which is where the crash happened in the summer of 1947. You know, most people had focused on the event itself. I decided to focus on what else was going on there. One of the things that amazed me was that there actually was a catalogue of deaths within Lincoln County in that exact same time period in which people had died from various types of plague and viruses. And what surprised me even more was that when I used the Freedom of Information Act, which is something I often do to secure the release of documents, I actually got hold of like a 700-page file that much of which was actually focused upon a catalogue, a series of weird deaths from plague and various other viruses right in the heart of Lincoln County in the summer of 1947. Now, what makes the story even more intriguing is that according to a number of the people who were involved in the Roswell event, some of the wreckage was taken to a military base in New Mexico called the Sandia Base. Now, what's interesting is that these same files, which are official files, as I said, which have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, they actually talk about how there was also an outbreak of this virus, this plague, at the Sandia base in the same time frame. So we have Lincoln County and we have the Sandia base both tied to the Roswell event in the summer of 47. And also in the summer of 47, we have an outbreak of this weird plague in Lincoln County and at the Sandia base. And the official records demonstrate that there was a major concern that the Sandia outbreak was actually deliberate, but it wasn't just due to a bite from an infected rat or something like that.
The title of the document that you got, right?
Yes, and so this is sort of a little-known aspect of the subject, which to a significant degree corroborates these off-the-record stories given to people like Tim Cooper years earlier of strange viruses and unusual deaths. And a number of the people who died, they're actually taken to a military hospital called Fort Stanton in New Mexico. And the documents talk about how it was everything from young children to adults, and they died very, very quickly. And it was perceived as being at least some form of plague. And the documents are fascinating when you sort of look at it from the perspective of what was going on in the UFO field at the time, and the stories about the crash and the stories given to Tim Cooper. And, you know, I have to say that it actually sort of dovetails very, very closely.
The title of the document that you got out of the FBI through FOIA, so this is not something that was mailed by anonymous sources, this is right from the FBI, is Bacteriological Warfare in the United States. I mean, that title suggests to me that somebody in the FBI thought it was bacterial warfare of some sort.
Yeah, there were major concerns that this wasn't just, as I said, you know, an outbreak of plague from flea bites or rat bites, that kind of thing, that it was something else entirely, to the extent that all of the files that related to these deaths in Lincoln County, all the documents on them were actually shared with the director of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, the director of the CIA, and the acting director of the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, when you realize that factor as well, that these strange deaths, these controversial deaths of young children and adults in Lincoln County, all the records, the autopsy files, the studies, were all being sent to the highest levels of the intelligence community, the CIA, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, the Atomic Energy Commission. They were all getting the documents on these unusual Lincoln County deaths. So, you know, and it all comes back to the summer of 47. Right where the events occurred. And to me, at least, this is one of the most sort of significant developments in the Roswell story, in the sense it doesn't ironically directly relate to documents on the crash. But when you look at it, what it does do is sort of vindicate what else was going on around in Lincoln County at the time, which we could apply to the crash itself. And I think that's an important thing to do when we're looking into UFO cases, is not just to look into the event, see what else was going on around town and around the area at the time. And it was through that process that you know, I was able to get hold of this file, which as you point out, is a FOIA document. It's not, you know, questionable or anything like that at all.
Well, this is what jumps out at me also about that file, and I think it is dramatic and significant, is that you got a file of 709 pages. But that was from a document of 1,783 pages, meaning more than 1,000 pages are still classified for reasons of national security, right?
Yeah, that's correct. This file actually dates back to from about early 1940s to about 1950, so you know, pretty much 60, 70 years old. And you're quite right, George, that substantial amounts of the documents, certainly more than 50%, are still withheld for national security reasons. And you know, the FOIA does allow, obviously, documents to surface into the public domain, but there are, you know, certain rules and regulations that allow for the continuation of withholding of documents, and without doubt that this is one of them, and we can only kind of speculate as to what might be contained in the additional material. And I find that intriguing, that such an old file should still
be classified.
Yeah.
You also note that this one boy who died of this mysterious plague had apparently contracted it at a very unique spot.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, again, this sort of comes back to, you know, the whole issue of what was going on and who was doing what and where and so on. But the boy in question, I mean, this is one of the more interesting ones. He died sort of very, very quickly, and he was taken to this place, as I said, called Fort Stanton, and actually died at the hospital there, right in Lincoln County. And he fell ill and was actually sent home initially, but then just got worse and worse, and literally died. He was just like 7.5 years old. But this was right in the heart of Lincoln County, and where he actually lived was literally like about 3 miles from the crash site on the Foster Ranch where the rancher Brazel found all the wreckage.
I should point out that for people that don't know your other books, is that you're not a guy who drank the Roswell Kool-Aid. You don't necessarily buy hook, line, and sinker the generic story that's told by the UFO community. You have questioned it and presented other scenarios, so it's not like you're singing to the choir here.
No, I mean, I've always been of the opinion that when we look at the UFO subject from any perspective of the subject, that we should look at all angles, because I always tell people that the U in UFO still stands for unidentified, and that's why I feel we should touch all bases. And that's also why I feel it's important to share these documents and this story of unusual deaths right in the same time frame and place as the Roswell affair, because, you know, if it were just being kept sort of in-house with the local local hospital or something, that's one thing. But to see that all the records on these deaths were, as I said, shared with the CIA, Air Force Intelligence, Atomic Energy Commission, this is sort of a major discovery, a major revelation, a major implications that, you know, I think more digging into this could possibly open up further angles as to possibly why Roswell was kept secret. You know, if there was sort of some sort of sinister viral aspect to the case, then that might arguably be even more of a reason to hide the truth than just the idea that a UFO crashed.
One other, we got to take a break in about 2 minutes. One other of the important historical cases that you touch on and sort of explore in a much broader context is Captain Mantell. Everybody who's read about UFOs knows the case of Thomas Mantell, who died while chasing a UFO. And folks have done a really good job of trying to dismiss that. He was confused. He didn't really see it. He ran out of fuel and he died. What's your take on that case?
Well, I mean, my take on the Mantell affair, which occurred in March 1948, when he was essentially vectored onto a UFO to try and figure out what it was. All we know for sure is that Mantell pursued or headed towards this object, and the next thing happened after he said that he could see this object and it was bright and huge was that his plane plummeted to the ground and he was killed. Now, the important thing is that clearly there was something in the sky, and various theories have been put forward that it was a large balloon called a Skyhook balloon. Another theory is that it was the planet Venus. To me, these don't hold water. The reason being that when you listen to theories like that, it kind of implies that Mantell was almost, you know, an inexperienced person who just wasn't used to seeing balloons and couldn't tell Venus from, you know, a flying saucer or whatever. And that kind of really does discredit to Mantell himself, because he was actually a very decorated pilot who served in the Second World War. And, I mean, he had countless hours flying. You know, he wasn't like somebody who was green and new to the subject of flying and just, you know, just signed up. No, he was somebody who had a long, sort of prestigious career and, you know, decorated in the Second World War. And so he was no fool. So he clearly saw something. And the fact that the official story was changed a couple of times, you know, has got to give rise to suspicion that that they actually saw something strange, and there was sort of like a scramble to try and figure out what it was, but from a down-to-earth perspective.
Captain Edward Ruppelt, head of Blue Book, he, in your book, you say he investigated, and he said, to use a trite term, it was a masterpiece in the art of weasel wording. We'll finish up talking about the Mantell incident and move on to other dramatic cases of where planes were vanished and crashed and people died under mysterious circumstances while trying to tell the truth about UFO encounters and UFO documents.